All right, so we are going to move on to item 7, which is a presentation from Siegel regarding the December 31, 2020 evaluation report.
I'm going to interrupt you, Scott. Did you do public comment and I missed that?
I did.
Okay, I missed it. I apologize.
Well, you didn't miss anything because there was no public comment, so it went pretty quickly. So all good. All right, so let's move on to item 7, presentation from Siegel. I see Paul. I'm looking for Andy. Oh, there's Andy. All right, I've got them both. So we have Andy Young and Paul Angelo with us this morning. So, gentlemen, good morning, and I'll let you take it from here.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, could I ask that we also admit our colleague Eva Yum? You've all met Eva, but she also will be sitting in with us today, if that's okay.
Certainly, I have no objection. I'm going to look to Christina and Gail to make sure that if she's in the waiting room or where she is. But
we are moving her right now.
Great.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll proceed. So we are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Paul Angelo. We're joined by my colleague Andy Young, and oh, there's Eva coming in from Siegel, and we are presenting the December 31, 2020. What year is this? 731-2020 actuarial evaluation report, which we do every year. I'm going to try to present this pretty much the way that we're accustomed to seeing it. So I am going to share my screen, and we're going to see the cover page of the evaluation report. Can you all see that there?
Yes.
Very good. All right. So I'm going to go, let's see. There's a little, whoops, I have to be in the document. There we go. And go to page 6. So the first few pages have some introductory text that just talk about, you know, why we do evaluation. There is a mention here of the amortization schedule. I will look at that in detail later on. That also shows up later in the report. So I'm going to continue to scroll down here till we get to really where the evaluation highlights begin. And then our format is the same as it's been for many, many years. We show here each of the major events of the evaluation. Then over here in the left margin, we show pages that you can jump to get more information about that topic. And that's how we encourage the trustees to read through the actual evaluation report. Now, a lot of the nuts and bolts here, I'm going to let Andy walk us through. We did have some prepayments. Here's one by the sanitary district. And there's mechanics about when they pay it and when it's effective and granting interest. So all the details are here, but what you will see in later items that will show the effect of that on the overall contribution rate. We love the fact that you have employers that, you know, that find the resources to make advance payments toward their unfunded liability. The second highlight here, we start with the assets and we move to the liability, the unfunded liability. Your funded ratio on a smooth value basis increased from about 90.5 to almost 92. And on a market value basis, you had, because you have strong market return, you went from 91.7 up to 95.5. You are floating there in that 90 to 100% range, great place to be for funded status. And we will look at the reason that's really because of your very robust funding policy as well as actuarial experience. And by the way, Mr. Chairman, I can only see about 4 of the faces on the screen here. So if anyone has any questions or anything like that, I don't know, please feel free to interrupt me at any time here. And I'll check in Chair Gordon every once in a while here to see if there's any questions.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Yeah, you like I, when the screen is shared, your gallery moves to the side. So I don't see everybody all at one time, but this is not a shy group, as you know. So if there are questions, anybody, please be sure to just go ahead and ask, because I'm not going to see a raised hand necessarily. Thanks, Paul.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. So next, bullet 3 here. Now with the unfunded liability, and it decreased from 947 million to 859 million. We talk here about the reasons, but I'm going to jump to one of my favorite pages, which is this page 31, which is the reconciliation of the unfunded. We'll go there in a second. And here we also talk about the amortization schedule. I'm going to make a little bit of a fuss about that, because that's why you're making such good progress. It says here, pages 89 to 104, you go to page 89, you will see a table for cost group 1. You are a complicated plan. You're like a little mini PERS. And so there's like a whole series of 12 cost groups. It's not till you get to page 101. That's where we see the entire plan together. Then after that come the graphs that are mentioned here. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to jump there to page 31. And so this is where we get from last year's unfunded to this year's unfunded. And I'm going to also, I have some notes in my hard copy here, so I'll flip that in here too, right here on the side.
And I guess, Paul, while you're doing that, I want to mention one thing, which is we were a group with 12 cost groups, but now we're up to number 13. So because of the
13. System. Okay, lucky 13. Very good. Thank you, Andy. So what we do in here, when we're reconciling the unfunded liability, again, last year, about $950 million. The first thing we look at is what would happen to the unfunded if all the assumptions came true, no surprises. And the way this works is you accrue a year of normal cost. We also put in administrative expenses, and then you collect contributions. Now, the contributions of $447 million are enough to pay the normal cost of $251, enough to pay the expected contributions. And whatever is left over is like a principal payment to pay down your unfunded liability. I want you to notice we go from 947 to 821 million. That's your expected unfunded. So you are deep in positive amortization territory. And we'll see why that is. So your expected payments from your employers and your members would have been enough to reduce your unfunded by 126 million in this single year. That's extraordinarily robust funding. I'm going to jump to those layers in a second, but let's finish this page first. You know, I say this 821 is what your unfunded would be if there were no surprises. There are always surprises. So we had investment return less than your assumed rate of 7% after smoothing. We did also have, the only place where, actuaries often, the things that we like, other people don't like, so if the retirees die too fast, that's very sad for the retirees. We call that a gain. Same thing for salary increases. If salaries increase higher than expected, which they did, that's good for the members, but it actually produces then a higher than expected liability. That's your largest single item in the reconciliation. That was largely offset by, again, COLA increases were lower. We are currently assuming 2.75% COLAs, and they came in lower than that. So there was a gain on COLAs, and there's another item about 11. So net, we have bad news, actuarial loss is about $38 million, which brings the unfunded up from the 820 up to 859, but still well below where it was last year at 947. So even with $40 million in actuarial losses, your regular scheduled reduction in the unfunded because of your amortization policy still showed a robust decrease of about $100 million from 947, we may call it $90 million, down to 859. Now, I'm going to jump to page 101 and have a look at this amortization schedule. There's a lot of numbers here. And as I say, this is the total of all cost groups combined. Back in 2007, we, working with the board, we restructured your amortization policy. And back at that time, there were 15 years left on your unfunded at the time, along with some POBs. So we let the amortization period continue to decline for that. And then for each new layer, you adopted an 18-year layered amortization. At the time, you adopted 18 years because that was the longest period you could have so as to have no negative amortization. Well, notice that 15 years ago was, that change was 13 years ago. So now there are only 2 years left. And your outstanding balance, instead of being $1,139,000,000, which was 2007, has been paid all the way down to $304,000,000. And what you'll see here for each one of these layers is like reading the rings on a tree. You can see each year what happened. Was there an assumption change? Was there a gain or loss? We got depooling in here. I mean, you really read the whole fingerprint and life history of a pension plan right here in this amortization schedule. You've been doing this so long, we had to go to a second page. So here now we have this 2015, and you can see each year, there's 1 year left. So this year we set up three new amortization layers. You had actual experience, was a total loss of about $37 million. And that's not quite the same as the number we saw before because you have some inactive groups where we carve that out separately. So that's starting a brand new 18-year period. And then there are two other things here. Again, there's the LAFCO prepayment. And also you do have one group that is in surplus. You have to make a special adjustment for that. But you add that all up, and here's the 859 total unfunded. Notice we add back in the terminated employers. Here's the payment of 193, about 194 million. Now, what I want you to really notice, we're going to show you a graph in a second. Look up here at this restart layer where there's 2 years left. That's 160 million. Well, that tells me that 3 years from now, that payment's not going to be there anymore. Well, starting a few years ago, we came up with a graphical way to show this. So here we have, these are all of those amortization layers. You know, some of them are combined, you know, into that happened in the same year. Green ones are gains and losses. You'll see there's those, the losses are above the zero line, and the gains are actually credits, so they're below the zero line. What you need to understand is the net unfunded liability, which is the bad news minus the good news, the charges minus the credits, the losses minus the gains, that net number is the black line. So you take the total of all the charges and subtract out all the credits, and that's this net number. And it goes down pretty smoothly over time until you're expected to pay off all your layers about 2027. Now up here, this red guy, that's other changes. That's that restart layer from back in 2007. And what this shows is it'll be fully paid off in 3 years. Well, if you're not excited yet, what's really exciting is when we look at the payments. So this is the same idea. The ones below the zero line are amortization credits from gains. The ones above the zero line are amortization charges, either from losses or this blue thing here. That is your those are assumption changes. Well, look at this chunky thing here. This is about, as we saw on that table, this is about $160 million. So what this means is that in year 2022 valuation, when we do the reconciliation of the contribution rate, you will see a decrease. Whatever else happens, you'll see a decrease of about $160 million. That's because the taxpayers in Contra Costa County, through your contributing employers, have fully funded that layer of unfunded that was sitting around back in 2007. We sometimes hear critics of pension plans say, talk about crowding out, you know, that public pension costs are crowding out public services. I'm not endorsing that statement, but I will say it's going to get a little bit less crowded in Contra Costa County in 2022. And that's only because of the robust funding policy that that this board and the predecessor boards adopted back in 2007. I will not wax on quite as excited about everything else, but I do think that's one of the most significant things you're going to see in any valuation report. And we have had some other plans that adopted layered amortization. We have one that adopted 15-year layered amortization 17 years ago. Well, 2 years ago, we had a little party when they paid this off. And then we had cake, and the trust, the administrator said, we want to be sure it's a layered cake. Get it? Layered cake. Okay, I'll go back to work now. Let's go back to the summary here. Again, I'll pause for any questions about that unfunded policy.
Just to digress for a second.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Holcomb.
We have a no cake policy at Cicera, regardless of the milestones we hit. And there's some history to that, but I won't bore you with it now.
We have pie?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Okay. Never mind. Well, we'll just have our layered graphs then. That's other. We'll have to content ourselves with those, Mr. Holcomb. Thank you. Okay. Very good. I got to find out about that no cake policy someday. But I'll just
quickly tell you that when I first joined the board, the assets hit $5 billion. And they brought in a cake.
No, don't do that.
And in about 3 months, the assets were $3.6 billion. We've never had another cake.
Yeah. Well, end of story. I will make a point, though. There's actually a little bit of a life lesson there, that assets do go up and down. The thing about your unfunded policy is once you get that red layer from 2007, we may have other gains and losses, but once that layer is paid off, it is not coming back. So there's more of a forward direction in time, more of an irreversibility, but you're absolutely right. You don't ever want to have too big a celebration because your assets cross a milestone, because, you know, the markets give us and the markets take us away. But there is a little bit more. I'm not saying we should get a cake, Mr. Holcomb, but there is a little bit more, I would say, predictability when you're paying off those past layers, the past layers. Not that there won't be new layers in the future. Okay. Very good. So the next thing, we've now dealt with bullet three, bullet four. We had a net loss from investments, and this is just sort of where the gains and losses came from. We'll look at that when we look at the assets in a second. But now let's move on to the average employer contribution rate. I always like to stress there is no employer in the plan who actually contributes 35.66 or 35.26. This is an average. And in this first section, we have a nice table that shows you all of the actual rate group by rate group, employer by employer contribution rates. More or less the same things that affect the unfunded also affect the contribution rates, but there's a couple new ones. And so again, here on page 33, we're going to see the reconciliation. Now we do also have, Andy, maybe tell us for just a second, there are a number of employer contribution rate schedules that have always been produced outside the valuation report. And I think, Andy, this year we've folded some of those in here. Can you just give us a quick bullet on that?
Yeah, there's a brand new schedule that we add to the back of the report. That is actually a schedule that we have been preparing for the staff. So that way, once the board approves the contribution rates in this report, those contribution rates can then be presented to the board of supervisors. We have one employer who came back to us and raised a very good question, which is, how can we be sure that we got the authority from the Board of Retirement to pass on those set of contribution rates to the Board of Supervisors unless they are also found in the valuation report? So I think we took that comment to heart and believe that an improvement in the process would be to put that contribution rate packet, at least the principal employer rate plus the employee rate, which has always been in the report, in the valuation report in front of the board today. So that way we can have a very good audit trail if that question were to come up in the future.
Very good. So Andy, that way when the board adopts this valuation report, they're also adopting that very specific set of rates that will go before the board of supervisors. So there's sort of a procedural connection, if I understand you. Okay, so let's go ahead to page 33. And so now we're looking at a reconciliation of this average employer contribution rate. Last year it was 35.66. Some of these items are familiar. We had investment return less than expected. That translates in 27 basis points, translates into 27 basis points. Actual contributions greater than expected. We did salary increases higher than expected. Now, here's one we didn't see before. When salaries grow faster than expected, it means your unfunded liability payments in dollars are now being spread over larger than expected payroll, so that actually lowers the contribution rate. So that's one that we did not see before because that only affects the rate. Here's the COLAs that we saw before. Here's another one we didn't see before. This is as the demographics of your active membership shifts among different tiers, that causes generally a reduction in normal cost. Now, Andy, make sure I don't get this wrong. Is this the, for example, people shifting from legacy tiers into the Pepper tiers, or is this just a more general demographic shift?
It would be the former, yeah.
It is. So when people say, where's the cost savings from pension reform? And that's really what we see here. So as members in legacy tiers retire and are replaced by members in the lower cost PEPRA tiers, this is 1 year's worth. That's a 0.25% reduction of 1 year of demographic shift from the legacy tiers to the PEPRA tiers. So you really see the gradual cost impact of pension reform right there in line 7. And there's always another. And then here's an item that we'll talk about a little bit. We did make a procedural change that we're recommending with this evaluation. It's down in the weeds. We have a paragraph on it up in the summary, but you can see in the aggregate that reduces the, that increases the employer rate by about 2 basis points. Now, I do want to make one, there's one comment I want to focus on here. Let's just see here. Just one more little thing. If we go back to this reconciliation of the unfunded liability, you may know, trustee's been around for a time, you've heard about the 1 year lag or the 18 month lag between when we do the valuation and when the rates go into effect. And for years, when we had a series of losses, for example, after the great financial crisis. You know, because of 5 years smoothing, the market loss in 2008 actually showed up as losses 5 years in a row. So we had contribution rate increases 5 years in a row. So every year, the new higher rates would be implemented a year after the valuation, and that would show up as a contribution loss. And we say, well, that goes the other way as well. Well, we get a chance to see how that actually went the other way as well. You see here 7B, this is a gain from contributions greater than expected. I just want to mention this. It's because from 2 years ago to last year, the rates actually went down. And so the old higher rates stayed in effect for a year. So you actually have a contribution gain. I only mention that because this is the mirror image of the contribution losses that we saw after the great financial crisis. So your funding policy of just letting that lag work out, we're now getting to see that it does sometimes come in the other direction. I just wanted to mention that for any of you who are familiar with seeing those contribution losses in the past, we did have gains this year. We'll probably see gains next year because, again, we have a reduction in contributions this year. I just wanted to highlight that point. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
Okay. Let me go to page 8. So we are now slugging through here. So we've now done the reconciliation of the unfunded under item 3. We've done the reconciliation of the employer rate under item 5. Now we get into some of the investment return stuff. Your rate of return on market value of assets was 9.5%, 9.57. But on a smooth value basis, it was 6.6. So we're going to go now and look and see why that is. Check my notes. So I'm going to jump to this page 23, where we actually go through a little bit about asset smoothing. Now, page 23 itself is one of these things you do not want to try this at home, where we actually do the asset smoothing, and we do it in 6 month periods because that's how your reserves are maintained. But I'm going to jump through here. Here we see the market value of assets and the smooth values, the actual value and the valuation value. You can't even see them. They're sitting right on top of each other. All I want to point out here is that, you know, in 2018, we had the market value was lower than the smooth value, and then they're kind of on top of each other. But we see here the little dance where sometimes a smooth value, which is the green squares, sometimes the smooth value, which is the red triangles, is higher than the market value. Sometimes it's lower. Oh, look, I told my staff, I want them to leave 2007 on here until the day I retire, because I want you to be able to see this was the great financial crisis. This was that negative return we had in 2008. We were doing a lot of smoothing, right? A lot of air in the ice cream between the market value, which was only $4 million, and your smooth value, which was about $5.5 billion. But over time, later gains and asset smoothing, and look, then they cross again. This would be another one of those days where we would have cake if we had cake, where we finally had no cake. So, but it is good to see, though, that these numbers really do cross each other. And so we have a situation now where, because we have two good market gains in a row, we have the smooth value below the market value. So we're actually deferring gains. That's like rainy day money. It's a little easier to see how smoothing works when you go to the rates. So I'm now going to go to the table of the rates for the last 10 years. So here's what we just said in the bullet. The market return for calendar 2020 was 9.57. And for 2019 was 14. But before that, it was -2. So this is the market value roller coaster here. And then these are your five-year smooth numbers. And the actual value and the valuation value are essentially the same, as you can see. And so what we get is, it's just a slower recognition of this market volatility. And because we do have a pretty chunky loss from 2018, and remember, when you see a -2.3, what I see is a -9.3, because your assumed return was 7%, right? So the loss actuarially is the 7 that you've assumed that you didn't get, plus the absolute loss. Well, I really think this is where a picture is worth 1,000 words. What we see here is, again, the green squares, these are now rates of return. The rate of return of market value, here is the almost minus 30 return that we had 2008, you and every other pension plan on in the country. Then here are the recoveries in 2009 and 10, well above the assumed rates. And so again, it's the same sort of market value, actual value dance, but now you see it magnified because they're doing it in rates of return. But you can see pretty clearly that the rates of return on a smooth value, the red triangles, clearly track the rates of return on market value, the green squares, but they simply dampen out the short-term volatility. So you deliver a smoother series of returns to your employers and therefore less contribution volatility. So great picture here of asset smoothing doing what it was hired to do. Okay. With that, I'm gonna go back to page 7. So the other things, again, we urge the trustees to read through the other sections in the report. This is where we talk about the asset smoothing and the unrecognized net investment gains that we just talked about. Now, as we get in here under this page, these are more of the mechanics of the report. We have additional contribution made by San Ramon Fire. The one thing I do want to mention is we do have a procedural change here, and I'll try to go through the details at somewhat high level. This has to do with in the legacy tiers for safety, when members reach 30 years of service, their contributions stop. And for the and the rates are determined. This is what makes the 37 Act pretty complicated. For the legacy tiers, the member contribution rates are determined in two parts. One for basic, which are based on formulas that are actually in the statute, and one for COLAs, which was added to the 37 Act much later and has a different procedure. By the way, none of this applies to PEPRA. Under PEPRA, the law makes it very simple. The members pay half the normal costs. Well, it's not that simple. So what we have is for the basic rates, the long established practice was that when the member reached 30 years and therefore they stop making contributions, well, the employer rate for basic legacy is the total normal cost minus whatever the members pay. So if the member stops making contributions at 30 years of service, it defaults and goes into the employer rate. So right now, the employer is paying the suspended contributions for basic, for legacy members with over 30 years of service. In contrast, for COLAs, and this is a historical practice that we Andy, I think we went back, we found at least 15 years back. As long as the COLAs have been in the law, the practice was to simply take the total COLA cost, the COLA normal cost, divide it in two and take half of it and have the members pay that. Well, what that meant was implicitly that when a person reaches 30 years of service, and they stop, a safety member, and they stop making COLA contributions, the missing contributions in effect get spread over the other members. So it's the exact opposite of what was done for the basic component. Now, as we say here, this can be if we were doing this all over again, we're not sure this would be the preferred actuarial practice, but again, this goes way back at least two actuarial firms ago. This is relatively stable as long as the demographics of the group remain pretty stable. But what happened was we had in a couple of your cost groups, your safety cost groups, a remarkable number of safety members reached that 30-year point. And this would actually have caused a material increase in the contribution rates for the other safety members in that cost group. I think, Andy, in one cost group, we trace this down to is actually one individual. It was a very small cost group. And a single individual hits 30 years of service, and suddenly that produces a cost increase for the remaining members. So we had discussed with staff, and it's our recommendation that we basically synchronize the practice for the COLA contributions to match the established practice for the member for the basic contributions, and basically have the employers be the default payer. I guess there's a little bit of, what is the intent of legislation? Do we believe that when the member contribution is suspended at 30 years, that is a feature that's to be funded by other members or by the employers? And we believe that the instructions that we have on the basic rate gives us a good indication of what the policy intent is there.
So that is a recommended change. You saw it had very small impact overall. It affects only the safety groups, but there are two of the safety cost groups where this will have an impact.
So Paul, let me stop you right there. Even though that item 7 is a presentation and item 8 is the ultimate action on this item, let's pause here. I want to see if there are any questions on this specific recommendation from any of the trustees. And if there are, again, I can't necessarily see you. So if there are questions or you want some refinement or additional information on this, please go ahead and ask Paul and or Andy at this time. If not, we will move on. Don't see any or hear any, Paul, so carry on.
Okay. With that, Andy, is there anything else here in the highlights? Well, here's the Alameda decision. Andy, why don't you summarize for us what we are or are not reflecting in this valuation with regard to the Alameda decision here in Contra Costa?
Right now, Paul, the shortest answer is we have not reflected any impact, neither in the assets nor in the liability. So I know that the board has had several discussions, but our understanding is that the decision has not been reached yet. So until the board reaches its final decision, we're going to be put on a standby pattern and not reflected, possibly maybe with respect to that decision as early as possible in the next valuation, December 31st, 2021.
And just so you know, I'll tell you, trustees, that's not unusual. We even have some June 30, 2021 valuations. Where we recently have not seen the impact of Alameda. The great thing from an actuarial standpoint is that this will show up. We can be fairly passive, actuarially speaking. You know, if contributions are refunded, it'll show up as an asset loss. If benefits are reduced for retirees, it'll show up as a liability gain. So this will be very much self-adjusting. We won't have to do anything in particular to reflect Alameda. It'll either show up in the member participant data or in the investment information. And then finally, ASOP 51, this is our third year having this in here. It's a standard on risk. We have a section here, it's mostly text. I have to tell you, when I watch a plan with this, in the 90% funded and your sort of contribution stability, I mean, obviously there are risks out there, but we are not doing a quantitative assessment, but we do have some text there to walk you through what are the risks of assumptions not being met, which any trustee of any longstanding will certainly be familiar with it from their own experience. And with that, prepared remarks on the presentation. Andy, you want to chime in?
Just one little thing. Even though we have not tried to prepare these scenario tests that we are familiar with in other jurisdictions whereby we test what happened if the investment return for 2021, for example, were to come in any different from the 7%. However, we are going to be providing a contribution rate of illustration of projections, assuming that all the assumptions were to be met, assuming that the return for 2021 will be coming in at 7%. I think that limited scope scenario projection will allow the employers to at least find out, as Paul has mentioned earlier on, in about year 2028, that is when we expect the UAL to be fully paid off. So the good news is, what would be the contribution rate when all the UAL would be fully paid off? And that will be reviewed as part of that illustration of projection.
So just to make sure I understand it, Andy, that's a projection that's done for informational purposes only. Although it sounds like the intention is that employers should be able to rely on that. Is that correct?
Yes, it's an illustration, although my understanding is the employers may have been looking at that as they develop the budget for the next several years, correct?
Okay.
We find those helpful for more short-term budgeting. You have to be a little bit careful about betting the ranch on the unfunded going disappearing as of some certain date, because after all, future assumption changes and future experience, investment, and other experience could definitely move that date.
All right. Any questions to Paul or Andy on these items?
I think...
John, there you are.
I was going to say, I think Andy has touched on this, but this is probably an appropriate time to ask Paul and Andy to
talk about their comfort level with 7%. It sounds like it's reasonable, but talk about it relative to both our own performance and what you see in the marketplace, also inflationary expectations. Obviously, there's a lot of inflation news out there now with great controversy as to how long it's liable to continue. And any other assumption issues that you think would be of interest to the board?
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. That's very timely because we actually can give you a more reliable answer than you normally get on that question from us. This has to do with the inflation. You're currently assuming 7% nominal return at 2.75% inflation component. We go to actuarial meetings and we take informal surveys, look at other folks, and the 2.75 is really right up against the border of a reasonable range. And so starting last year, Siegel has been recommending 2.5% inflation to all of its systems. Now, Contra Costa has a particular history here. Two studies ago, you're doing your next study next year in 2022. Two studies ago, we were recommending 3%, and this board chose to go to 2.75% because the analysis that we did could support either. So you folks went to 2.75 when we were still recommending 3 to most of our plans. 2 years ago, the previous study, we came in, we had moved our across-the-board recommendation to 2.75. You were already at 2.75, so you stayed there. And that's why if I went back and looked at the 2019 experience study, and the inflation did not change, and the nominal return did not change. In fact, your real return had actually gone up, and so you actually were able to increase your confidence level under our model. So you have been at 2.75 inflation and 7% nominal return for 2 experience cycles. We can tell you now with certainty, when we come in next year in 2022, we will be recommending 2.5% as the inflation component. Now that means if, when we do our analysis, if there is no basis for recommending a higher real return, so if the real return stays the same and the inflation component goes from 2.75 down to 2.5, then the nominal return recommendation will go from 7 down to 6.75. That's not a prediction, but that is, I would say that's a reasonably likely alternative unless something in the study justifies a higher or lower real return. So Mr. Phillips, we can tell you that sort of if you had to place a bet, you could probably make a safe bet that you're looking at a good likelihood of 6.75 nominal and 2.5 inflation in 2022. And by the way, you will then be, I think, number 4 or 5 in our corral. The 675 and 250 is a fairly common combination, just as the 7 and 275 was a fairly common combination. And that's both, I think, nationally and here in California. Mr. Phillips, does that get to your question?
Yes, did it nicely. I think obviously it gives the board a chance to reflect on that being at least a reasonable expectation when we get our next study. It makes sense to me. Thank you.
Thank you. I will also mention that, you know, we have seen talk about, is there going to be a spike in inflation because of either recovery or because of economic stimulus? You know, we are long-term funders. It's a long-term assumption. So I have not heard any buzz in the actuarial industry that we are going to see the trend toward lower inflation assumptions reversing because of what we're seeing, what we believe is still relatively short term.
So on this point, now that we're having this conversation, and I remember this a couple of cycles ago in terms of 3 versus 2.75, mm-hmm. I'm just trying to understand if we're talking long term, the shift in 2 cycles from 3 to 2.5 seems somewhat noteworthy to me in terms of significance. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think it is. I will tell you, we have seen, we in our California practice, we have, you know, we tend to look at this in kind of a 3-year cycle, partly because most of our plans, you know, even though they're not on the same 3-year cycle, they're all on 3-year cycle. We have seen that inflation component go down 25 points each 3 years, I think going back to when it was 3.5%. And I think that is certainly consistent with both what we see in fixed income returns, which have a large inflation driver. You know, back in the day, you could, your bonds would pay you 6. Bonds are paying you 3. So I think, Trustee Gordon, we are looking at a new normal, if I can use that phrase. We just actuaries just tend to get there in small steps. So, you know, someone could say, oh, you actuaries, you know, you should have been at 2.5, you know, 6 years ago. Well, we tend to get there in small steps. But I think it is significant. And it's part of this very overall shift. You know, the Fed is, you know, I mean, I was working back when we had hyperinflation back in the 80s. I don't know anybody that thinks that's going to happen again. It's just, it's a different level, I think, of federal management of inflation. So, but I do think we are in a new low inflation environment, and actuaries just sort of take their time getting there.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think we've been in a low inflation environment for at least the better part of a decade or more. So, yeah, it's starting to be a thing.
Yep.
Okay. I'd throw in the interest rates on 30-year treasuries, I think, are a reasonable marker on what the market thinks about future inflation, and they're unbelievably low.
Mm-hmm.
Jim is the right one to opine, but. It does suggest exactly what Paul was describing.
Is that so-called break-even rate? You know, you compare inflation-sensitive to non-inflation-sensitive treasuries, and there's a spread that can give you the market's implicit prediction of inflation. By the way, I always like to point out, we're all guessing, including the market. So just because that's what the treasuries tell us doesn't mean it's right, but you're absolutely right, Mr. Phillips. That number has been low for a long time.
Jay Kwan, you had a question, it looks like, for Paul.
Yeah, it's not so much a question as maybe as a small comment. Just to be clear, from my understanding, the idea that, 6.75 with the 2.5 inflation is kind of one of the likely outcomes assumes that the, as you said, right, the expected real rates of return going forward are constant. And that's following, you know, this run up since COVID, right? So there's a pretty decent chance there's going to be some assumption on forward looking returns there that could further lower that 6.75 as a possible outcome.
Mr. Kwan, you're absolutely right. I can tell you, for example, Fresno County did an experience study this year, and we recommended the lower price inflation. Same, from 2.75 down to 2.5, and their capital markets, they had done a study 2 years ago. So they did an out of cycle review for other reasons. And in the 2 years, they had very little change in asset allocation, and their real return dropped by over 25 points. So they actually went from 7 down to 6.5, 25 from inflation, 25 from real return. So I do not want to say that that is in any way off the table. In fact, if anything, my 675 and 250, that's at least what will happen. But you're definitely right, Mr. Kwan. If we look at the real returns, again, both on asset allocation changes, if any, and the changes in the capital market expectations, that could lead to another 25-point decrease in the recommendation. That is certainly a possibility. And you would not be alone down there.
Paul, can you also comment on with the system's current funding ratios and volatility ratios being what they are, how that also lends a further discussion around those matters of inflation and investment return?
Thanks, Gail. What that really does is it magnifies the impact. Andy, what page is the volatility ratios on? Can you tell me that in the table of contents real quick?
It's page 48, Paul.
48. What we do is we have a little statistic that we use called volatility, liability volatility ratio and an asset volatility ratio. And all this is we take the accrued liability, not the unfunded, but the total accrued liability divided by payroll. And what you can see here for general, it's at about 8, and at safety, it's about 21, which is quite high. So what this means is every change in assumptions has a greater impact on the plan. And then the other thing is, because you're over 90% funded, you'll see that your asset volatility ratios and your liability volatility ratios are pretty close. So similarly, every investment gain or loss has a greater impact. And so going to Gail's question, it's being well-funded, it doesn't really necessarily change what assumptions we recommend, but it will change how great the cost impact is. So you will see greater changes in contribution rates in reaction to either investment experience or to assumption changes than you had in the past. The other thing you always have to notice here, look at general versus safety. Let's suppose we recommend an assumption change and the board adopted an assumption change that changed the liabilities by 10%. 10%. Okay, well, 10% of 8, that would mean that you would actually have a change in liability for the general tiers equal to about 80% of a year of payroll. Whereas for safety, the same 10% change in liability would represent over 2 years of payroll. So this also shows why whenever we have an assumption change, the rate impact on the safety is much, much greater than it is on the general tiers, simply because the liability to payroll ratios are so much greater. So, Ms. Strom, I don't know if that's what you were after, but I think that the funded condition and the maturity, it really is more of a driver of the impact of assumption changes, perhaps less so than the assumption recommendations themselves.
All right, any other thoughts, questions on this item? I'm sure the employers are paying attention. So carry on, Paul.
Okay. No, actually, Mr. Chairman, this concludes our prepared remarks on this item. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other thoughts, comments, or questions for Paul and Andy on the presentation item 7? I'm not seeing any, Paul. So Paul and Andy, thank you very much.
I will take
the presentation down. As always.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll stay on for the next item in case there are any questions there as well, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent. Thank you. I was going to suggest you do that, so I appreciate that.